It's the BBC's 100th anniversary, and on Radio 3 Breakfast, each day, I'll be bringing you a piece of popular music broadcast from Manchester or London in 1922. In captivating new arrangements, specially recorded by the BBC Philharmonic. Join me, Petroc Trelawney, to sample Sounds of the 1920s each morning on Breakfast from 6:30, all week, on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
It's just after midday. Time for Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the writer Julia Blackburn.
Julia Blackburn was born into a family dominated by alcoholism, drug addiction, domestic violence, mental instability, and suicide. Amazingly, she survived, indeed thrived, as a prolific and wide-ranging writer, the author of novels, poetry, plays, and books about historical figures, including Napoleon, Billie Holiday, Goya, and the Norfolk artist John Craske. She's also written books about grief, her love of animals and the natural world, and published memoirs, including a moving, indeed jaw-dropping book about her childhood, The Three of Us. Julia, you've brought us pieces by Beethoven and Pergolesi, folk songs and music from Central Africa. But first we're going to hear something connected with the process of writing. It's the Lykewake Dirge, sung by Peter Pears in the setting by Benjamin Britten, part of his Serenade for Tenor Horn Strings. It's an ancient English folk song telling of the soul's travels on its way from earth to purgatory. Why this?
This is a piece of music that was given to me by Mary Wesley, the writer Mary Wesley, who was a kind of guide to me for several years. And she sent it to me as a little sort of rattly tape recording, which I kept. I was writing a book about a woman called Daisy Bates, who at the age of 50 went to live in the Great Western Desert alongside the Pitjantjatjara Aboriginal peoples, and I was trying to make a transition between having it as a clear biography, if you like, but because Daisy Bates told lies, Mary Wesley said, it doesn't matter, you can invent the story and go with it in whichever way it goes. And when I had this Peter Pears doing the song, The Lykewake's Dirge, I found that every day when I started at my desk, I would put it on and it would do that sort of click of shift so that I would step out of one world and into the other.
And there's something in the plangency of Pears's voice that makes it particularly affecting, isn't it?
It's extraordinary. It's extraordinary. When I listened to it again after a pause, I was startled by how absolutely plangent he is, how absolutely he sort of enters it. It's a lament, and it's also got fear in it as well, which he manages to convey.
Christ, receive thy soul.
Peter Pears with the dirge from the Serenade for Tenor Horn and Strings by Benjamin Britten. Eugene Goossens conducting the new symphony orchestra and the unmistakable horn playing of the great Dennis Brain. Julia Blackburn, can you paint a picture of your childhood with your parents? Your father was the poet Thomas Blackburn, your mother the artist Rosalie de Merrick.
A picture. The picture would be, I think it's encapsulated by the word bohemian. That they were the sort of, both from very repressed backgrounds in their different ways. They discovered Freud and they discovered freedom, and they were in the post-wartime thing where, as the other song goes, anything goes. And they were complicated. My father was prescribed a drug called sodium amytal during the war when he was giving lectures in the fire service. And that increasingly, completely sort of overwhelmed aspects of his mind. And he was also a serious drinker. My mother was my mother. But it was, yes, it was also all out in the open. I think that was it. I mean, the sort of classic is coming back from school and my father in the studio with my mother, and I walk in my uniform and sort of short socks, and he says, "Your mother has been false to me. Do you know what that means?" And it, you think, I don't quite, but I've got a rough idea that it means trouble.
When you came to have children of your own, what sort of parent were you?
Ah, well, I think so often you try to be different to your parents, and then you miss out on other things. It's that it goes sort of, you know, ricocheting down the generations. That I was, for instance, terribly unclear about, say, the facts of life, because my mother was too keen on the facts of life. And I don't know. I loved my children. I love my children. I have two, a daughter who's very musical, as well as being a psychotherapist, a son who's in the theatre, works in theatre. And I gave them a childhood that I hoped was different to my own, and I think that they've emerged triumphantly, each in their own way. But I possibly, I don't know, one does one's best.
I think animals helped you to survive your childhood.
I was a solitary child, and I think that I mistrusted from a very early age, which makes it rather odd to be a writer, I mistrusted the meaning of words. They seemed to have many layers of meaning, none of which were quite absolute or clear. And I could much better converse with a cat or a dog, and also just in watching. I would be able to watch insects or toads or frogs or small creatures, which gave me a kind of quiet. And when I was about, I think I was 11, I was told to go to Harrods and choose a pet, and I went to Harrods and had a sort of waffle between a mongoose and a bush baby. And I chose a bush baby who was an extraordinary companion for the short year of his life. But he would just sort of whisper in my ear and stay with me as soon as I came home from school, and was in my mother's studio in the evening time, where he would jump along the picture rail and have absolutely no house training, so that the whole studio smelt like the lesser mammal house in the zoo.
There was also comfort in music, and you've identified with Billie Holiday. You feel that she got you through, as it were, growing up. But did you identify with her because she'd also had a terrible childhood, marked in her case by poverty, violence and rape? Or was that something you found out later when you were writing about her?
That, I think, what happened with me with Billie Holiday, it was a first encounter, really, with the power of music and voice. And it was very specifically, I was at a party, I would have been 15 years old. My mother had a party to which she had invited two strippers and a guy who was also good at stripping, as if he was a woman. And it's one of those memories, possibly, it was so sort of, it was so edged with danger on all sides.
But was this, were they invited for the benefit of your father, do you think?
No, he'd gone by then.
Right.
He'd gone by then, and I'd been going with my mother to Mallorca, to Dea in Mallorca on holidays. And there, she and I had, or she at first, and then me later, got to know a prostitute called Sally. And Sally and her friend Barry, they were sort of edging into the family life. And somehow they got invited to a party. I think it was even said, this is going to be wonderful. We've got Sally and Barry and someone else. And I can see them, they arrived with a great sort of roar of delight. And amongst, in this sort of Putney house, they took everything off and started dancing and saying things. And everybody thought it was hilarious. I thought it was frightening. And it was chaotic. It was a wild party. And I can still remember that I went over to the record player. We had one of these sort of red plasticky covered record players. And there was a record by Billie Holiday, a Billie Holiday memorial. And I put it on and it had something. I just sat listening to it. And the next day I went to buy the record in Putney High Street. And it was suddenly this idea of somebody who, when she sings sad, she makes it happy. When she sings happy, she makes it possibly somber as well, but she had a kind of energy of survival. And so from that first time, I then for many years played her and played her and played her and could sing all the songs. I can't sing, but I could still now recite pretty well every song she's ever sung. And she was in that way a companion. And then later I wrote about her. I felt, what am I doing? I got no right to write about this woman. But then I thought, I'm not a jazz person. I'm not an African-American. I'm not all these different categories that she had. But what I did have was a sense of complete abandonment in early life. Mm. So I felt I could fight her corner. And to me, rather like that lovely Stevie Smith poem, Away Melancholy, I felt it was her virtue needs explaining, not her failing. And she stayed with me still every time again when I hear her. I'm sort of elated by her courage, I think it is.
Thank you. heaven, you'll find your fortune falling all over town. Be sure that your umbrella is upside down. Trade them for a package of sunshine and flowers. If you want the things you love, you must have showers. So when you hear it thunder, don't run under a tree. There'll be pennies from heaven for you.
Billie Holiday with Pennies from Heaven, music by Arthur Johnston, lyrics by Johnny Burke. Julia, your relationship with your mother, Rosalie, reached a crisis when her boyfriend began an affair with you. I mean, he was 30 years older than you. You were still in your late teens, and you eventually moved in with him. And although it didn't last long, it completely devastated your relationship with your mother for a lot of the rest of her life.
It changed. It was like a sort of car crash in the mind, and I think that it changed everything in my way of being, and also in a curious way, I think, in trying to understand what had happened, it shifted me when I came to writing, that I was drawn to writing about people in a predicament. People who had some, whether it was Billie Holiday trapped in Harlem, Goya trapped in deafness, Daisy Bates in a desert, all these different people were somehow trapped in one way or another. And in understanding and empathizing or getting close to my awareness of how they were, I think I was working something out, possibly, in my own mind. I don't know, but because I always felt that whatever I said, I wasn't going to be understood, but that it was a predicament that I'd been in from which I couldn't somehow get out. Although I did. I got out with writing and I got out with life. I never felt destroyed by it, but I certainly felt that, as I say, as if my direction of being was changed.
Did manage a more complete rapprochement with your mother when she was in her 80s, didn't you?
We had this wonderful, simple thing that I was friendly with her, close with her. I tried to help her as she got older. And you know, we had on one level, we had a very good relationship, except every so often she'd say, you know, if it wasn't for you, he would still be alive and I would be happy, sort of thing. But she was slightly ill with one kind of cancer. She then got leukemia, which was going to be very fast. And I took her to the hospital. They said she'd got it. She stayed in the hospital for 2 days, and then she said, would I go and collect a notebook for her? I went to get the notebook from her house, and there was this note on. I'd given her the notebook, in fact, a sketchbook, and on the first page it said, blow me down. It said, I'll never, never, never forgive Julia for what happened in 1968, or 67, or 66, or whatever it was. So I thought, this is no good. I can't look after her. I can't do anything unless we finally cut the thread of this one. So I went and said it to her, and suddenly, like the whole principle of absolution right at the end of life, she said, oh, gosh, it can't have been that easy for you either, could it, darling? You know, that was not, gosh, that must have been rather hard, and this is rather difficult, and all water under the bridge, I remember her saying that. So then I took her home, and she had a month to live, exactly. She stayed in my daughter's bedroom, and my children came to see her, people came to see her, and she faded. And with this incredible sort of process of it, she said, I never knew I could be so happy. How funny to be dying at the same time. And we had a kind of rapprochement, a closeness, which meant that I could let go of her. She could let go of life without this turmoil. I could let go of her without the sense of unfinished business. And I, for the first time in my whole life, I could actually love her, I suppose.
Mm. Well, music now that reminds you of the long periods of time you've spent in Amsterdam. I think you first went there not long after leaving home.
Yes, I started a love affair with a sculptor called Herman Mackink, and he had a studio in Amsterdam, and I first went there when I was 18, and then we went on together to live in Mallorca for a couple of years. And then after we'd parted, I came back to Amsterdam and was there, I think, again for 2 years, and then had 3 years with my two children and learnt to speak Dutch. Fluent pidgin, which is my speciality in all languages, but also then a sort of closeness with another country. And I still feel more at home in Amsterdam. I've lived there more recently than in London, really.
Well, what you've chosen is from a 1978 Dutch LP of medieval music that you brought in for us. And it's rather wonderfully titled Music for Church and Pub, Court and Street, Love and Lust, War and Peace. This is the Agincourt Carol, isn't it? A 15th century folk song.
It conjures up that medieval, it's like a medieval tapestry. There's a sense like a Bruegel painting or like one of those tapestries of marching soldiers. There's a sense of humans on the move, human energy, which I like.
The Agincourt Carol. We heard Musica Reservata, directed by John Beckett. Julia Blackburn, I mentioned that you are a prolific writer, the author of more than 24 books, as well as plays, stories, across a dizzying array of subjects. And there's often, I think, a blurring in your books between you and your subject, particularly in the biographical works. Do you think that's deliberate, or does it just naturally happen?
I think it started when I wrote the book Daisy Bates in the Desert that I was referring to at the beginning, where you realise if you're studying a person and you're reading their letters, you're looking at photographs, you get to know them in a way as closely as other people, even though they are long since dead, and you have a kind of conversation with them. I think that I began to enjoy allowing the dialogue between myself and my subject to be part of the study of the person. But just the logic of, if you follow a life closely enough, you begin to see what they saw and see how they were within that context.
Are writers different, as your father maintained, from other people?
Oh, no, that's rubbish that he says that. That's, you know, and then poets are the highest grade of the writers. No, I don't think they are, except for that tendency for a kind of the introspection to be put into words.
You've asked to hear the first two tracks from an album curated by Pierre-Laurent Aymard, wonderful pianist, starting with music from Central Africa and followed intriguingly by Steve Reich's clapping music. Why do you suppose he put these two pieces together?
I came up with this music when I was starting to work on my last book, Dreaming the Karoo, about a group of bushmen in the Kalahari and also in the Karoo area, the Kham. And I was listening to music from all over that sort of area, particularly hunter-gatherers and their music without instruments, their voice music. And both Steve Reich and Philip Glass were very interested in listening to the a cappella voice music of hunter-gathering people and learnt from their way of working in a group or working individually and speaking that that music without you understanding the words becomes this complicated discussion, if you like, musical discussion, where you move quite seamlessly from particularly the music of the Akar Pygmies into the music of the absolute sort of state-of-the-art modern music. And it's just that. I like the dialogue between the two.
So we're going to hear traditional vocal music by the Akar Pygmies from Central Africa and then go straight on into Steve Reich's clapping music, where one performer claps the same rhythm repeatedly and the other gradually varies it.
Oh,
I like that music because it's very clean.
Yes.
Steve Reich later wrote various pieces which are more indulgent in a way, almost sentimental. He was performing there with the pianist Pierre-Laurent Aimard. And before that, we heard traditional vocal music from the Akka Pygmies of sub-Saharan Africa. Fascinating choice, for which many thanks. And you can find details of all the music chosen by my guest today, Julia Blackburn, on the Private Passions website. And if you go to BBC Sounds, you can enjoy hundreds of previous editions of the programme. Could we talk a little bit more about your husband, the Dutch sculptor, Herman Macking, who died in 2013. And 'tis really a remarkable story because you had a brief relationship in the 60s, drifted apart, had children with other people, and didn't get back together again until 1999, when you finally married. Why do you think the first relationship failed and the second one was such a success?
The first relationship failed because I think me in particular, but possibly he also, were not quite fully formed as to who we were and what we were doing in this life. I certainly wasn't. And it had all kinds of complexities, but underneath the complexities was the fact that we got on very well. And I think when you're young, you can underestimate how crucial it is to actually get on. And then when we met again, we'd bumped into each other occasionally in Amsterdam, but he came to visit me because he was in London and he said, I'll drop by and visit. And he came to the railway station, the local railway station, and got off the train. And I just had that very simple thing, which I didn't say anything about, but thinking, he's come back. It was mending the beginning. It was a sense of tremendous sense of a whole lot of things that hadn't made sense suddenly did, because they'd done the circle, they'd completed the circle. And yes, we had a very happy time, but he got cancer after about 5 years of us being together and had very, very extreme treatment. And then we had a further 10 years with him getting more frail as time went on. But it's that rare thing when you're at one with another person. It's an extraordinary thing.
You live in Suffolk, but you also spent a lot of time in Liguria in northern Italy, where you befriended the pianist Massimo Anfossi. And I think you want to hear him playing Beethoven's Sonata Fantasia in D major.
I do indeed. Massimo is married to Iliana, who runs the shop in the little village in the mountains there where Herman had a house, and I now have his house with my additions to it. And there was something always so wonderful that he would leave the village and the shop with its sort of votive candles and its cheeses and its whatever else's and go off and play. He's an exquisitely wonderful pianist.
Thank you.
The first movement of Beethoven's Fantasia in D major. We heard the composer's sketches reconstructed by Roberto Tigani and performed by Massimo and Fossi. Julia Blackburn, we're going to move to Pergolesi's Stabat Mater now, because actually your life does seem so eventful. And once again, this brings back memories of a rather extraordinary moment in your life, which could have been potentially devastating, couldn't it?
I've sort of carried it with me a long time, the Stabat Mater. I listened to it when my daughter was in labour. It has this compassion and this mixture of voices of somehow that you can be thinking about somebody and the thought is answered, almost like a kind of embrace without any contact. And then the same, only totally different, that my son had what could have been a fatal accident, but it wasn't. He dived into a pool where there was a concrete block that was not mentioned on the sort of little notices, and he hit his head. And he just had his second child, who was 3 months old, I think, and his wife and his daughter and the second child were there by the water, and lots of other people were there too. And he was rushed to hospital, and he had broken a vertebra in his neck. But he was all right. He got through it, and I was phoned up, and I drove at, 9 o'clock at night or something to Bristol. And I thought, just as I was leaving, I would take this with me. So I played it all the way through, over and over, as a kind of a affirmation of survival, if you like. So it has that quality of it in my mind, and it's accompanied me with my two children.
And you've homed in, I think, on particular artists, Emma Kirkby and James Bowman.
I think that they're two voices together. It's a dialogue that is so moving to hear it each time again. The way that they answer and merge, question and reply. It's, I suppose the awful word is sublime.
Thank you. not just the wonderful voices of James Bowman and Emma Kirkby in the first movement of Pergolesi's Stabat Mater, but sort of visionary harmony too. It does what you don't expect it to do quite often. We heard Christopher Hogwood directing the Academy of Ancient Music. We talked earlier, Julia, about your pretty awful childhood, and I wonder how you feel now when you think about your parents, and especially when you read your father's poetry and look at your mother's paintings.
My father, although he was chaotic, I'd never really had a quarrel with him. He taught me language. He taught me endless poems that I still have rattling around in my head. And he wrote a wonderful poem for me when I was about 15, which ends up by saying, "May chaos, though, have light within your mind and be of use." And I think that I've carried that as a parental gift, if you like. And I don't have any quarrel with him at all. And with my mother, in that miraculous way that once a quarrel is settled, it disappears. So I feel that I've had an incredibly blessed life, and actually a very contented life, even if sometimes I felt slightly as if I was out on a rather wide ocean on a raft. Yes, it is our virtue needs explaining, not our failings.
Well, we're going to end on a celebratory note indeed, because I understand that you've just got married again.
Yes, not as something at all that I thought would happen. I thought I would trundle off into the last chapter on my own. But miraculously and extraordinarily, I have fallen in love with a wonderful man, Christopher Lucas. And we get on, as we were saying about the nature of getting on. We seem to get on with a harmony, or not seem to, we do get on with a harmony that means that it's very, very straightforward to share our lives together, walking into the uncertain future. So hand in hand we go into the last stage of the life, the last chapter of the life.
And it is some music you went and heard together that's prompted your final choice, isn't it?
Indeed, it is. There was the Flipside Festival. It's a literary festival, mostly literary, in Suffolk. They had a musician called Hannes Buda coming, and he's a German, born in 1978, East German. He performed in a very intense, small gathering of people in a beautiful barn, and there was something in it that seemed to connect with the medieval and the very modern, with even the sort of voice that you get in Bach's cello solos as well. And it was very nice to be there with Christopher, and it seemed to sort of be a rounding up of the kind of music that I've always been attracted to.
This is No Death and No Regrets from Hannes Buda. So, Julia Blackman, thank you very much for sharing your private passions.
Well, thank you enormously. It was a delight to do. Thank you.
Death and No Regrets, music from the 2021 album Outside Words, composed and performed by Hannes Buda. And that was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, the writer Julia Blackburn. The episode was produced by Jane Greenwood and it was a Loftus Media production for BBC Radio 3. And as Michael said, you can find details of all today's music if you search online for Private Passions on the BBC Radio 3 website or on BBC Sounds, where you can also download hundreds of previous editions of the programme. Private Passions returns next Sunday at the same time, 12 noon, when Michael's guest will be the stonemason and conservator Simon Warwick. This is BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and on BBC Sounds. It's 1 o'clock now, and this is John Shea with the latest BBC News. The Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, has told the BBC that everyone will pay more tax. He also confirmed that spending cuts will be part of his plans when he gives his autumn statement on Thursday. Speaking on Sunday with Laura Koonsberg on BBC One, he said the government would continue to support people with their energy bills, although there would be some constraints. He said the most vulnerable would be protected, but the difficult decisions had to be made. The Shadow Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, described the hole in public finances as a mess of the Conservatives' own making. The mayor of Kherson in southern Ukraine has warned that the city has no stocks of bread or medicine days after Russian troops withdrew from the area. Some residents have also been left without heating, electricity or water. Russian soldiers remain in place just across the Dnipro River, from where they've launched artillery attacks, which have landed close to Kherson City's airport. Despite that, people are continuing to celebrate Russia's retreat. Ukrainian flags are being prominently displayed and the national anthem is being played out in the city. Services have been held across the UK to pay respect to those who've lost their lives in war. Wreaths were laid at the Cenotaph in London during a Remembrance Sunday service this morning. King Charles led the ceremony for the first time since becoming monarch. New government figures show that almost 41,000 migrants have now crossed the Channel to the UK this year. The new record number far surpasses the 28,500 people who made the trip in total in 2021. The government says it's seeking a new deal with France to tackle people smuggling. In the United States, President Biden's Democratic Party has retained control of the Senate by holding on to the state of Nevada. Catherine Cortez Masto narrowly defeated her Republican rival Adam Laxalt, who was publicly backed by Donald Trump. The victory means Mr. Biden has a much better chance of pushing through his agenda. England's men have won the T20 Cricket World Cup. Their victory over Pakistan in Melbourne has made history. They've become the first team to win the trophy while also holding the 50 overs title. And the weather, areas of low cloud are expected in the east. It'll be dry and bright for most, but it'll become cloudy in Northern Ireland. BBC News and Weather at 2 minutes past one.
Composer of the Week takes a trip to New York after World War I.
There was a great deal of energy.
Join me, Donald MacLeod, as I dive into the cultural explosion of the Harlem Renaissance with the jazz trumpeter and composer Wynton Marsalis.
Jazz musicians were such a fascinating breed of people, and there were a lot of musical geniuses around.
Looking at pioneers like Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Langston Hughes.
You couldn't believe a person could do what